B'shalom.
Hey, thank you. Good morning, everyone. And again, obviously, our tefillot are for the chayalim. I noticed, just interesting, just to show you the difference in perspective, I noticed in the English update, that magazine, so one of the columnists reproduced a letter or a statement. One was a statement of one of the mothers of the three boys, Mrs. Yifrach, and the other was a statement by the mother of the Arab boy, the Palestinian boy that had been murdered. And although, once again, our mercy and our compassion have to be for both mothers, a mother that loses a child certainly deserves rachamim and compassion, but one letter spoke about the hope of reconciliation, the hope of peace, the hope of bringing Am Yisrael together, and the other said, we need more revenge and more killing. And it shows you that people can respond to tzoros in different ways. And it's really Mikamcha Yisrael that even in the middle of great, great tragedy, we have tzidkaniyos that try to respond with dignity and kindness and compassion, even towards those who try to destroy them at the same time. And Baruch Hashem, so many of those tunnels were discovered and are going to be destroyed or filled up. But you know how dangerous that is. The tunnels are booby-trapped and all sorts of things are going on. So although Baruch Hashem, and we hope it continues, Yerushalayim has been zocha to relative safety, but that should not remove our kavanos from those who are really in danger every single moment of the day. Rav Tzadok has an interesting observation about the 3 weeks. Rav Tzadok points out that if you look at the haftoros of the 3 weeks, each of them addresses, they're all from Yirmiyahu, unlike the 7 haftoros of comfort that are from the Navi Yeshayahu. The 3 haftoros of paranios, of tragedy, are all taken from Yirmiyahu. And in many ways, Yirmiyahu himself is the most tragic of the prophets. Because unlike other Nevi'im who were giving long-term predictions of what would happen after they died, Yirmiyahu was forced to live and relive all of the tzoros that he described. In fact, at some point, he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Moshe Rabbeinu was zocha to take the Jewish people out of Avdus. And I am given responsibility of bringing them into Avdus and Golus and Chorban. Even Yechezkel, who was a contemporary of Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel prophesied about the Chorban and was alive during the Chorban, but Yechezkel was already in Babel. Yechezkel was not an eyewitness. Yirmiyahu went through everything. And as a result, when Chazal look for the epitome of tragedy, they take the nevuahs from the book of Yirmiyahu, because he himself, as he wrote in Eicha, Ani hagever ra'ani, I am the person who saw my nation's affliction. I didn't just prophesy it. I didn't just predict it. I didn't just describe it from a distance. I was there. But Rav Tzadok points out that each of the haftoros begins with a different human sense, one of the 5 senses. The haftorah we read yesterday is Divrei Yirmiyahu, the first parak, the words of Yirmiyahu. So Rav Tzadok says, the first week of the 3 weeks, we try to be mesakein our dibor, our speech. Next week's haftarah, shimu devar Hashem, listen to the words of Hashem. That is a tikkun of what we hear and what we take in. The third haftarah, and I'm sorry, I misspoke. The third haftarah is actually from Yeshayahu, the haftarah before Tishbav. So 2 are Yirmiyahu and the 3rd is Yeshayahu. This is Shabbos Chazon. Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amoz. Vision. So first you fix what you say, because that's the thing that's most within my control. I have the most control, as hard as that is, I have the most control over what I say. Then I try to control and be misaken what I hear, and then I can move to a higher madrega when I am misaken what I see, which really means what I perceive as reality. So I want to focus, because we had just read about the tikkun of the koach of dibor. It's worthwhile to think about the power of speech that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. Of all of the human faculties, it is speech that is most closely correlated with divinity. Because speech is really uniquely human. Seeing and hearing, all animals have. Everyone knows the Targum Unculus. Vayipach biyapav nishmas chayim, Hashem breathed into man the spirit of life. And man became a nefesh chaya, a living creature, because God breathed into him. The Targum Unculus says, nefesh chaya, a living spirit, is ruach mamalala, a ruach, a spirit that could converse. The koach hadibur. And when we think about the koach hadibur, we think about it in two ways. We think about the tremendous potential it has to destroy. We know, when we heard as children, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. But we know that although that may give a child temporary feelings, in reality, the words can destroy much more than the sticks and stones. Sticks and stones break bones, but Baruch Hashem, in most cases, bones can heal. Bones can heal. But the hurt and the pain and the shame and the humiliation of words, of insults, can last a person throughout their lives. In fact, as strange as it is, if you look at the lives of politicians, leaders, who have wreaked a great deal of havoc in the world, you will find, as bizarre as it sounds, that these were rooted in childhood experiences of humiliation and shame. I remember Richard Nixon, although again, I'm not at all comparing Richard Nixon to some of the real bad people in the world. In fact, in retrospect, compared to our present president, Obama, Richard Nixon doesn't look so bad, actually, even with Watergate. But Nixon, who was forced to resign the presidency of the United States because of dishonesty, because of lying, all sorts of bad things, was giving an interview. And he couldn't stop talking about playground insults from the sixth grade. That somehow, this is still on the mind of a person who was a disgraced president of the United States. Connecting his life to those events. The power of words are awesome. They can destroy. But words can also bring comfort, bring strength, bring encouragement. How much a good word can mean to somebody who is lonely, who is sad, who feels they have no friend in the world. People pointed out, I remember hearing a story years ago, about a woman, I don't remember if it was Israel or the United States, she decided one day to commit suicide. Okay. And she decided that the most convenient way of committing suicide would be to rent a hotel room at the high story of a hotel, and then she would jump out the window, jump off the balcony. But the problem was, even when you want to commit suicide, things don't always work out. There was no room that was available till 6 p.m. at night. So she sat in the lobby for 6 hours. During those 6 hours, nobody spoke to her, nobody talked to her. And at 6 p.m., she got her room, went upstairs, jumped off the balcony, committed suicide. One wonders what would have been if even one person might have approached her, asked how she was. Could that have changed her life? I think there's even a play or a story about this, about somebody's about to kill themselves and they get a wrong number call. It starts into a whole conversation that, that saved a person's life. Now again, who knows Hashem has his hashgacha, of course. But I think we have to recognize, along with the tremendous harm that words can cause, we have to remember the tremendous blessing. That's why it is godly. Maves v'chaim biyad halashon. Shlomo HaMelech said, life and death are in the hands of the tongue. But I would suggest it doesn't just mean literal life and literal death, but whether a person is given a life or a person feels so destroyed is a function of the Koach HaDibur. But when we look at Koach HaDibur, we're looking at something else too that's especially relevant in these days, and that is the Koach of prayer, the Koach of tefillah. Because obviously, although tefillah is called primarily avodah shebelev, the service of the heart, but we fulfill it through the articulation of our lips, of our speech, and therefore tefillah is also, the koach of tefillah is connected to the koach of the pen. This is what Yitzchak Avinu meant when Esav, when Yaakov appears before him, looking like Esav, but using the name of Hashem. So Yitzchak doesn't know who's in front of him, so Yitzchak says, Hakol Kol Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Yaakov. Hayadayim Yidei Esav. The hands are the hands of Esav. What does the Gemara in Gittin say? This is not just referring to the voice and the hands, but rather the power of Yaakov is in the kol, prayer. And the power of Esav is in brute force, the Yadayim. And the Koach of Am Yisrael. Now again, on one hand, we don't rely on miracles. We have to fight. And it's a very important idea that we're not pacifists. Habal laharkecha, someone tries to kill you. We are commanded to kill. But we have to know that Koach is ultimately in the Koach tefillah. By the way, also we have to remember too, and I've mentioned this many times, but it's always worthwhile to remember that just as the Midrash says, Hashem told the Malachi Ashares not to sing his praises when the Egyptians are drowning, because they're Maisa Yadai Tavu Bayam. So this is the dichotomy. If Hashem was so unhappy that the Egyptians were drowning, why was he drowning them? But the answer is, this is exactly the contradiction that we have to live with. The Rishayim had to be destroyed. There was no other choice. And we don't say, out of my love for humanity, let them live. But when they are destroyed, it is done with sadness. It is done with regret. It is done with a sense of tragedy, not only for what we're going through, but what the other side is going through. And therefore there is never a glorification of bloodshed. There is never a celebration. That's why the Rambam says a very interesting point. The Rambam points out, just said, I guess for a second, then I'll come back to the Koach of speech. The Rambam points out that Eretz Yisrael was conquered by war in the time of Yoshua. Yerushalayim was conquered, at least in the time of David HaMelech. It's not so clear. Yerushalayim was apparently conquered in different stages. But the final conquest, and that's how the Iriya counts its 3,000 years, they count from the conquest of David HaMelech. So Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim was conquered by war, but the Har HaBayis was purchased. David HaMelech purchased the Temple Mount from Aravna, the Yavusi. And the question was, we conquered everything else, why couldn't we just conquer the Temple Mount? And the Rambam in the Mora Nevuchim says an amazing and beautiful thought. He says, yes, we conquer what we have to conquer, but the place where God's presence rests on earth can only be through shalom, it cannot be through violence. And therefore the Har HaBayis had to be purchased and not conquered. And therefore David HaMelech, as we know, was disqualified from building the Beis HaMikdash because he was a man of blood, although all the Muhammads of David HaMelech were absolutely justified and necessary. And in many ways we find that the zechus that Shlomo had to build the Beis HaMikdash was in the zechus of David HaMelech. That's what it says, that when the Aron was brought to Yerushalayim to be put in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the door of the Kodesh HaKadoshim didn't want to open, or the gates of the whole Beis HaMikdash closed. And that's when Shlomo HaMelech said, Su Sharam Hashechem, open up! And the gates didn't open up until Shlomo HaMelech said the Pasuk, Bavor David Avdecha, Al Tashay Pnei Mishichacha, because of David your servant, do not turn the anointed one aside. So the interesting is, the whole Beis HaMikdash was built in the zechus of David HaMelech. But David HaMelech himself could not be the one, because the Rambam says, Hashroas HaShechinah requires shalom. It cannot come through milchama. And in fact, without getting too technical, there's even an interesting halachic construct that emerges from this to think about. According to, you know, the Gemara discusses at great length, it's very relevant for Shemitah, by the way. The Gemara discusses whether mitzvos tuluyos biorets, like Shemitah, like Truma, like Maaser, do they terminate when there's a korban? In other words, does the land lose its sanctity? Not intrinsically, the land is of course holy, but does it lose its sanctity in terms of mitzvos tuluyos biorets? And the Gemara makes an interesting distinction, lahalacha. The first sanctification, which occurred when Yehoshua conquered the land, actually terminated when there was a Chorban Beis HaMikdash. So if after the Chorban, you would somehow find yourself in Eretz Yisrael and you would eat fruit or vegetables, you would not have to take off Truma and Maaser, because the Kedusha Rishona, in the language of the Gemara, the Kedusha Rishona, the initial sanctification of Yehoshua, Kidsha L'Shata, was sanctified for its time, V'lo Kidsha L'Yasid Lavo, and did not have sanctification for eternity. But when the Jews returned to Eretz Israel in the days of Ezra, they resettled a much smaller area. A lot of the kibush of Yehoshua was not resettled by the Jews in the days of Ezra. It's a smaller area, and that is called the area of Kedusha Sheniyah, the second sanctification. And the halacha is, the second sanctification is holy for eternity, which means to say, even after the Chorban by Yesheni, that area is still chayav in Truma and Maaser and Shemitah, which is why the areas that the Jews live in today is largely the area that was settled by Ezra, and that is why we take off Trumas and Maaseres. But what is the difference between the first sanctification and the second sanctification? Why should the first sanctification be temporary and the second sanctification be permanent? Answer, the first sanctification came through war and conquest. The second sanctification, there was no war. In fact, we came back to Eretz Yisrael under the authorization of Cyrus, the authorization of Koresh. There was no milchama. So here too you see that the holiness that comes from shalom is greater than the holiness that comes from war. Something to think about. We fight, but we also know that it is not the ultimate bracha. The ultimate bracha is only comes from shalom, and that's what the Mishnah, the last Mishnah in Shas, the last Mishnah in the whole Talmud, says, "Laimatza Kadosh Baruch Hu kli machzik bracha ela hashalom." Hashem has not found a utensil that could hold blessing more than peace. Hashem owes liyamo yitain. Hashem gives us strength. Strength means to fight, to destroy, to do what we have to do. But it is never an end in itself. It is Hashem yivarech esamo b'shalom, that it should lead to shalom. But coming back to the koach of speech. Let me share with you an interesting Gemara in Kedushin about the power of prayer. The Gemara has a maisa, it's a very interesting story, about a ruined building, an abandoned building in town that apparently was occupied by a demonic monster of some sort. And we won't get into the issue, are there demons or are there not demons? You know, as you know, Chazal talk a lot about demons, Shadim. Talk about how you can see them and what they do. The Rambam, on the other hand, said there's no such thing as demons. That's superstition. The Vilna Gaon, on the other hand, says the Rambam is wrong. He was led astray by Greek philosophy. And if Chazal say there are demons, there are demons. And in the 19th century, somebody asked the Kutzker Rebbe, is the halacha like the Rambam or the Vilna Gaon? And the Kutzker Rebbe said, there certainly are demons, but once the Rambam says they don't exist, even the demons respect the Rambam's view and just disappear. This is what the Kutzker Rebbe says. But, be it as it may, just looking at the story without getting into whether there are demons or not, everybody was afraid to go near this building. This demon terrorized the town. So the great Abaya said, I know what to do. There's a great tzaddik coming to town. And when this great tzaddik comes to town, nobody should offer him an accommodation. So he'll be forced to sleep in that building, and we're not going to tell him what's in that building. And I know that when the monster attacks him, he will daven, and in the zechus of his prayers, the monster will be killed. So this great tzaddik comes to town. Nobody offers him hospitality. Very strange. So because there's, you know, Ein Breira, he sleeps in this building. And this monster is described as a seven-headed monster, a hydra-headed monster. And every time the monster wanted to eat him up or burn him up, he would be mispalo, and the monster lost one head. And after seven tefilos, the monster was dead. The next day, he bumps into Abaya, and Abaya says, did anything happen last night? As if he didn't know. And the person says, well, yes, yeah, something did happen last night, and I was put in this place. And he said to Abaya, how could you endanger me? How could you put me in a place where I might have died? And Abaya said, you were safe. I knew you wouldn't die, because I knew your tefillos would be effective. Well, that's a pretty strong statement in and of itself, but the Marsha asks a very interesting question. The Marsha says, even if Abaya was apparently 100% sure that this person was such a great tzaddik that his tefillos would be listened to, but there's another unfairness here. And the unfairness is, the Gemara in Tainus says that when Hashem does miracles for you, you lose some of your share in Olam Haba. Because since miracles are otherworldly, miracles are events that are not within the laws of nature, you are getting a reward that's Lamaila Min HaTeva. It comes out of your Olam Haba, which is Lamaila Min HaTeva. If I get physical rewards, if I get wealth or success, that doesn't come out of my Olam Haba, because these are physical rewards. But when I get Hatzalah B'derech Nes, Menachin Lo Mischuyosav, you deduct some of your merits. You have less reward in Olam Haba. So it's not fair for Abaya to do that to him. The Marsha's answer is the following. Since the tzaddik was answered through the koach of tefillah, the koach of tefillah is not a miracle. The koach of tefillah is part of the laws of nature. It is part of the laws of nature that tefillah has the koach to rip up a gezar din. And therefore, the Marsha says, lahalacha, any miracle that happens through tefillah is called derech hateva. It's not called derech neis. And as a result, the tzaddik does not lose any of his zuchuyos. Now, we do understand that tefillos are not always answered the way we want. Everyone knows the famous deep remark of the Panevitcher Rav, that sometimes no is also an answer. It's not that Hashem doesn't answer, He always answers. He's always a shomea tefillah. Sometimes the answer is no. But that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon. tefillah could be payo Yeshuas in such a great level. They tell a story, and I'm pretty sure this story is a fake story, because the timeline doesn't work. But they tell the story that during the Battle of Britain, during World War II, when the Nazis were bombing London every day, and people were going into the tube, the underground, and, you know, every day there were bombs, and it was a very, very difficult time in England. And the truth of the matter is, it seemed that many, many times that the Germans might be able to conquer Great Britain, just as they had conquered France, and who knows how that might have changed the whole path of the war effort. That's why Ashgacha put in a fellow like Winston Churchill at that particular time. By the way, I don't know if you know that Winston Churchill was, I believe, High Commissioner of Palestine in an earlier part of his career. He actually lived in Jerusalem, and he wanted to come here after he retired. In fact, there's a YouTube video. This is just an amazing thing. This goes back, this is a snippet, to the 1920s, early 1920s, where there's a reception with Lady Churchill, Winston Lady Churchill, and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld and Rav Kook together are in the receiving line. And as Rav Kook is walking by, Lady Churchill sticks out her hand for Rav Kook to shake. And Rav Kook really was, like, he went back like 5 feet, like he was like so shocked. And Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld just like kind of walked around and gave Rav Kook a grin. It was very, very interesting, you know, but okay. But be it as it may, so the story goes that the Gerer Rebbe, who was smuggled out of Poland, the Imre Emes, had a meeting with Churchill. Again, I can't vouch this is true, and Churchill certainly didn't know Yiddish. But whatever. And the story goes that Churchill asked the Rebbe, you know, we desperately need help. What can we do to get victory here? So the Gerer Rebbe said, supposedly, do you want the miracle answer or the natural answer? So he says, well, first tell me the miracle answer, because I may need miracles. Well, the miracle is you get your army together, you get your air force together, you get your navy together, and you devise a coherent military strategy to defeat the Nazi armies. That would be a miracle. He says, okay, what's the natural way? You take the book of Psalms and you pray to God. That'll be the natural way of doing it, and that way. Okay. So that's the co-op. Again, as I say, the story is probably not true because I just don't see how it fits the timeline. I don't believe the Gerer Rebbe ever came to England, but nevertheless, this is the story that is told, and it makes a very, very significant point. The koach of tefillah, the koach of prayer. In connection, if I can go ahead to next week's parsha, there is another reference to the koach of prayer that's a bit indirect, but still a very, very powerful reference to prayer. We're going to read next week, and the Torah has talked about this before as well, about the Ir Miklat. If somebody kills another person inadvertently, b'shogeg, so the Torah says there were cities of refuge, Arei Miklat, throughout Eretz Yisrael, where the Rotseach b'shogeg goes. And if he steps out of the Ir Miklat, even one step, actually, let me be a little accurate. It is not only the Ir Miklat that gives him protection, it is the 2,000 Amma radius around the Ir Miklat, a Techum. So even if he leaves the wall of the city, if he is within 2,000 Amos of the city, he is still protected. But if he takes one step out of that 2,000 Amos, and the Goel Hadam, the relative who's the blood avenger, kills him, the Goel Hadam is off the hook. The Goel Hadam has the right to kill him. Now, there is a machlokes. Is it a mitzvah for the Goel Hadam to do it? There's actually an opinion that says the Goel Hadam should kill him. Or is it only a permission that he's not going to be prosecuted? Or even more than that, it's actually a sin, but he doesn't get punished for it. But be it as it may, the Goel Hadam can kill him with impunity. How long does a person stay in the Ir Miklat? It's very strange. This is the first indeterminate sentence. He stays in the Ir Miklat until the Kohen Gadol dies. If the Kohen Gadol dies one day later, he's free. If the Kohen Gadol dies 50 years later and the Rotzeach dies first, he's literally buried in the Yer Miklat. So you could have a sentence of one day, you can have a sentence of 50 years, a life sentence. By the way, interestingly enough, if the Kohen Gadol died before the Rotzeach was sentenced, and at the time the Rotzeach was sentenced, there was no Kohen Gadol, even if they appoint one later, he's there for life. So it's interesting. Kohen Gadol dies 1 minute before I'm sentenced, I'm there for life. 1 minute after I'm sentenced, I go free right away. That's the Gemara has different drushes. And in fact, the Gemara has an interesting discussion like this. Very interesting analogy. I don't want to get into the lumbus too much, but it's theoretically a fascinating problem. Let's say a person is a Kohen Gadol. The Rotzeach is sentenced to the Yer Miklat. And then we discover that the Kohen Gadol's mother had been a divorced woman. If a Kohen marries a divorced woman, the child is a chalal, and he's not a Kohen. So the Gemara says, if we thought he was a Kohen, and now we discover he's not, do I treat it as if the kahuna died, in which case the Rotzeach goes free, or do I treat it as if there never was a Kohen Gadol, in which case the Rotzeach stays for life? It's an interesting shaila. Mesa kahuna or batla kahuna? Mesa means we treat the kahuna as if it existed and now it died, which will work out good for the Rotzeach. Or do I treat it as a retroactive annulment of the kahuna, in which case there was no Kohen? And the Gemara draws analogies to other areas as well. What about korbanos? A Kohen brought korbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, and we discover his mother was divorced. Are all the korbanos puzzled, or is it only mikan ulahaba, only prospectively? But be it as it may, the Mishnah in Makos gives us the following message. The Mishnah in Makos says that since if a Kohen Gadol dies, the Rotzeach goes free, so the mothers of Kohanim Gedolim used to send care packages of treats to the people in the Yer Miklat, in order that the people of the Yer Miklat shouldn't be mispalel that the Kohen Gadol would die. It doesn't say that they shouldn't hire a hitman. It says that they shouldn't be mispalel that the Kohen Gadol should die. So the Gemara asks the Kasha, the implication is that if they would be mispalel, it could cause the Kohen Gadol to die. Why is that so? The Kohen Gadol didn't do anything wrong. Why should their prayers be effective against the Kohen Gadol? For which reason you need treats. This is a kasha that is asked both by the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Bavli, and the Talmud Yerushalmi. They ask the same question. They give two different answers, but each answer has a very interesting implication with respect to tefillah. Let's first give the answer of the Talmud Bavli. What's the kasha? Why would the Rotzeach's prayer be effective? The Kohen Gadol did nothing for which he would be culpable and deserving of death. The Bavli answers, yes, he's not innocent. He in fact is culpable, because he could have prayed that these homicides should not occur under his watch. If he would have davened more, these lives would have been saved. Haya lo lehispalel al doro v'lehispalel. Now, here's the question on this. And therefore, his failure to pray, or to pray enough, or to pray with enough kavana, is considered to result in these different deaths. Therefore, he is not blameless. Therefore, he is subject to death by the prayers of the Rotzchim, for which there needed to be a bride. Now, let's think about this for a moment. In order to go to an Yer Miklat, a person does not go to an Yer Miklat if he kills somebody by an unavoidable accident. If, for example, somebody is standing on a roof and the roof collapses and he falls and he kills somebody, that is what is called an onus. For an onus, you don't need any atonement, and there is no Yer Miklat for an onus. In order to be called a shogeg, the homicide has to involve negligence, carelessness, what we would call manslaughter. So, for example, if I'm driving a car and I go through a red light, or I don't stop enough at a stop sign, or I don't look where I'm going, so it's accidental, but it's careless, it's negligent. Now, l'chaira, whether or not somebody is careless or negligent is a matter of their free will. They choose not to be conscientious drivers or whatever. Now, we know that the one thing HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not interfere with is the bechira of a person. So how could the Kohen Gadol be expected to pray that people shouldn't die under his watch? It's one thing to pray there shouldn't be a tsunami, there shouldn't be an accident, there shouldn't be an earthquake. But how can I pray that drivers shouldn't be careless? That's a matter of bechira. If it's a matter of bechira, don't we have the rule, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven, chutz meyiras shamayim, except for the decision to fear God. And my decision, whether to be careless or not, is whether I'm going to live in accordance with Hashem's will. So how could tefillah work? Now, lemaisa, one answer might be that even if I can't pray that this guy should be a safe driver, because that's his bechira, but I can pray that nobody be in the way. That's a separate thing. In other words, I can't pray that you shouldn't go through a stop sign, because that's your bechira, but I can pray that Hashem shouldn't cause a child to be there. That's one answer. But the Chazon Ish says a different answer. The Chazon Ish says that the koyach of tefillah is so great that tefillah can even change the bechira, that the choices that human beings make. That's why, for example, the Chazon Ish says, I can pray that somebody does tshuva, including myself. How can I pray that somebody does tshuva? Now, bishlama, if I pray that I want to do tshuva, that could be by expressing my desire to do tshuva, Hashem will give me siyata dishmaya, based on the idea that the derech that you want to go is the way Hashem will lead you. But how can I pray that somebody else should do tshuva if they're not in that place? They don't want to do tshuva. And yet I can pray. Isn't that up to their bechira? And they didn't make any choice yet. I made the choice to pray for my tshuva, but they didn't make the choice for their tshuva. So why should my tefillah work? The Chazon Ish says, you see from here that the koyach of tshuva overrides even the koyach of tefillah, the koyach of prayer overrides even the koyach of bechira. And that is why the Kohen Gadol, according to the Bavli, is culpable, because his prayers could have made drivers safer. And if his prayers could have made drivers safer, his prayers could have saved lives. And that is why he's Chayav Misa. And that is why the mothers of the Kohanim Gadol had to bribe the Roshim not to pray. Everyone understands what you see from the Bavli. By the way, to mention another point, the Gemara also tells us that through tefillah you can take somebody's shidduch. The Gemara says that me'ikir adin, you can make an erison, which means a shidduch. You can make a shidduch even during the 9 days. You don't have a party and this and that. And the reason is because if you don't nail somebody down, although I don't like to describe marriage that way, if you don't nail somebody down, shema yikadmenu acher, maybe somebody else will get her or him. Even though it's decreed in Shemayim, who gets married to whom? Rashi explains, shema yikadmenu acher bitafila, through tefillah. Of course, you have to be careful to know what you're praying for. In other words, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed that the shidduch is better this way, you know, maybe you're getting something that's not good. But still, HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers tefillah. Shem Yeked Menu Achad. So this is what emerges from the Bavli. Right? The Bavli asks the question, why would the prayers of the Rotzchim be efficacious? The Kohen Gadol did nothing wrong. Answer, the Kohen Gadol could have davened to prevent these tragedies, and for that he is responsible. Tefillah can override Bechira. Now, as I had mentioned a few moments ago, the Yerushalmi asks the very same kasha. Why would their prayer be effective? The Kohen Gadol did nothing wrong. But instead of the Bavli's answer, the Kohen Gadol did something wrong, you know what the Yerushalmi says? Now this might be a little scary. The Yerushalmi says, you're right! Kohen Gadol is totally innocent! But tefillah can work against him anyway. Meaning, the power of tefillah is so great that chas v'shalom, even if the tefillah is for an illegitimate, wrong punishment to befall somebody, tefillah has that kalach. Now that's a little scary, because that would suggest that prayers have a certain power. Even when they come from rishus, there's a certain power that prayers have to bring out spiritual forces in the world. Rav Tzadok says this idea, and again, it's a difficult idea because there are riots against it. He says, whether or not a prayer gets answered does not depend on the righteousness or evil of the person offering the prayer. It depends totally on the depth of the sincerity and kavana, which means to say, theoretically, even a Rasha Gomor who comes with a depth of sincerity. Now, it happens to be, because it is much more likely that a righteous person will have greater kavana than a Rasha, so as a practical matter, the prayer of a tzaddik is generally going to be answered. But Rav Tzadok's chiddush is, the reason why the prayer of a tzaddik is answered is not because he's a tzaddik. And the reason why the prayer of a rasha is not answered is not because they're a rasha. Rather, what determines whether prayers are answered is the depth of the kavana salev. So theoretically, even the rasha gomor, who reaches a depth of true kavana. Now, the Yerushalmi is scary, because the Yerushalmi suggests that there is a certain power in the prayers of Rishayim. And indeed, there's a medrash that suggests that this is why Yishmael is such a dangerous enemy. Yishmael's very name, Yishmael is of course the ancestor of the Arab nations, Yishmael's very name is Yishakel, Hashem listens. Yishmael was given, as a child of Avraham, a kayach of tefillah. And if it's true that Esav comes with the yadayim, physical force, and we counter that with the kayach of kol, of tefillah and Torah, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, a very early medrash, says, Yishmael is the most dangerous of all, because they come to some degree with the kayach of tefillah as well. And even though it's not worthy, even though it's done berishus, it has a koach. And if it has a koach, the only way we could countermand it is with a stronger koach of tefillah. This is what we do against Yishmael. So if you consider the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, you see these two ideas. According to the Bavli, the koach of tefillah is that the Kohen Gadol could have changed the choices that people made. According to the Yerushalmi, the kayach of tefillah is the tefillah of the Rotzchim, that they could have condemned the Kohen Gadol to death, although the Kohen Gadol was blameworthy, was blameless, because their tefillah could be payo, even against a person who does not deserve that punishment. By the way, this explains the final question, and that is, if the Rotzchim were so determined to daven that the Kohen Gadol would die, then how does a box of cookies change them? They're going to be bribed with a box of cookies? I mean, what did the mothers bring them? They didn't bring them a car, you know. So the Svara is like this. It's not that because they got the cookies they didn't daven. But they no longer davened with the same intensity. Since they felt some level of positive feeling, that was enough to take away the kavana b'leiv shalem. And once it wasn't the kavana b'leiv shalem, the tefillah is going to have less of its power, less of its assistance. So these are things that we think about in which the beginning of the 3 weeks, we work to be misaken the koach of dibor. In being misaken the koach of dibor, we recognize both the immense negative power that words have in terms of lashon hara, onas devarim, hurting people, embarrassing people, and the tremendous positive power that words have to comfort, to strengthen, to give encouragement, to build people up. And then, most importantly, the koach of tefillah, the koach of prayer, the koach of opening ourselves up to Hashem, recognizing our vulnerability, recognizing that without siyata dishmaya, there is no way. Again, we are in a situation, again, in some ways, the very darkness of the situation is the greatest light. The darkness of the situation is such that it has become apparent that there is no political resolution of the situation that we face in Eretz Israel. You can pretend, whatever you do, disengagement, you know, whatever you do, comes back to haunt you with destruction, bombing. You know, Land for Peace has proven to be totally unworkable, and yet holding on to territory also proves to be unworkable. I remember when I was, I used to teach at the University of Maryland, so I noticed that after basketball games, there was always like rioting and drunkenness, so I was asking somebody what it was, and they said, well, when we lose a game, you know, we riot. And then, like a week later, they won a game and they were rioting. So they said, well, when we win a game, we riot, we celebrate. So it's like, you know, you win, you riot, you lose, you riot. Well, that's a trivial example, maybe. Although in Talish Park, it wasn't so trivial. But the truth of the matter is, Eretz Yisrael, in a much more important way, it's exactly the case. Give up territory, we get bombed. Hold on to territory, we get bombed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, there is no political solution to this. There is no diplomatic solution. There is no negotiation that's going to work. There is nothing at all you can do to make the situation better. And you live day by day. That's very bleak. That's very tragic. That's very sad. But ultimately, it is the greatest message of all. Because when we realize there is absolutely nothing we can do, then we are left with what Chazal say, "Ein lanu lihishoein ella alavinu shebashamayim." Now we know all we have is Hashem, but that's all you need is Hashem, because there's nothing else that works. America, whatever it is, there's nothing. There's nothing. The Jew stands alone in the world, but so is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Medrash says a beautiful point. The Medrash says that the word levado, aloneness, is used with respect to two entities. When Yaakov is struggling with the angel of Esav, Vayivatzer Yaakov levado, Yaakov was alone. And the Medrash says, there's a pasuk in the Nevi'im, V'nisgav Hashem levado b'yom ahu, that Hashem will be alone on the day of the Gula, that all the enemies will be vanquished. And the Medrash says that the mita of being alone is also the mita of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yisrael is alone, Yaakov is alone, Hashem is alone. But the aloneness of Yaakov allows us to connect to the aloneness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is the great nechama that we get in the middle of such a difficult and tragic situation. And the way that we connect to Hashem and attach ourselves to Him is primarily through the Kayach of Tefillah. So I hope that all of us will take advantage of these great, great brachos and open up the gates of Rachamim. Yeah, we'll